Our next presentation is by George Greenwald, a member of Clementine Explorations, professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley, and before that, he did have a career with Anaconda Mining Company. He's going to be talking about proactive prospect advancement, discovery, permitting, community outreach, and pilot drilling of the Clementine prospect in the Northern Pioneer Mountains of Southwest Montana.
Happy to be here at the invitation of both the Montana DEQ and the U.S. Forest Service to share our story about Clementine. I want to preface my comments by saying that the mine life cycle, I think, is a perfect example of a relational enterprise, both the way human activity relates to the earth and the advancement that we've made in understanding mining over the last 100 years or so to the point where environmental sensitivity is a vital aspect of our industry, but also relational in terms of how we as humans interact with other people. And that's part of what this talk is about. I want to also point out, if you look at our logo here for Clementine, it looks like a pick and shovel. Only the shovel is a blue LED, a light-emitting diode, so that while humans continue to rely on Earth resources for metals and energy materials, some of the materials that we use now are very different than they were just even a decade ago. And part of our purpose in Clementine is to discover copper as well as metalloids to make semiconductors. The Clementine prospect is located in southwest Montana right there, about 17 miles southwest of Butte. Right now we're up in here somewhere in Fairmont. We're located out in on national forest land, and because it's on national forest, Beaverhead Deer Lodge National Forest, north of Divide and Wise River, permitting was a very important part of this effort. And I'm going to start by talking about the discovery process here, an exploration strategy that is deserving of a social license in this relational mode I talked about. In that, we generated a new regional tectonic ore-forming model that was constrained by an overlay of regional environmental sensitivity. So our way of implementing that in the discovery process was to make it an integral part of where we looked. We limited target selection to underexplored prospective areas outside and well away from proposed special land use areas for wilderness recreation and other types of protection. And at the same time, our technical strategy was to use state-of-the-art real-time field methods of GPS-supported digital mapping, not just point data capture, and then taking your data back to the lab and creating a map then. Our map actually guide us in the field with evolving map patterns. My career started out with the research on the deep low-grade copper molybdenum ore body in Butte. Over the rest of my career, which took me to field sites on every continent on the planet, I was always haunted by why Butte and Bingham occurred where they were in the crust. And I've been lucky enough since I retired to come back to that question. And what we realized is that both Butte and Bingham, two of the largest copper deposits in North America, occur along a great big thrust fault shown in blue there, where to the west, that region has been moved to the east and overlies more ancient Precambrian basement to the west. And what I've done in collaboration with other people is to realize that the reason why great big blobs of magma brought enormous amounts of copper and other constituents up to the surface is that fault shown here in cross-section, based on work here by Tom Calliclay, allowed magmas to come up, and then inside of anticlinal folds form laccoliths, large bodies undergoing massive amounts of enrichment of metals, much larger than the porphyries that we see in Bingham or Butte themselves. They're way too small to be the parent magmas, but in this structural model, we added to this then that inside of these anticlines are low pressure zones that allow those magmas to saturate with water and explode and hydrofract and give off the full metal complement that's been fractionated inside these laccolithic intrusives. We also see on a regional scale, there's a number of thrust faults. Clementine is in the first thrust slice here on the so-called severe thrust and fold system. And we give a name to this. It's an ore deposit that formed with mechanical dislocation. We call it syntectonic, and it's in the frontal thrust fault, and it's an anticlinal bend. And in that, we discovered a mineralized system. On a smaller scale, if we now look at where Butte is up here, this is the Pioneer Mountains. I realized that there was a whole string of smaller deposits going southward down through the Pioneer Mountains that were old mining districts. In fact, Montana became a state after Bannock gold discovery to the south of this belt. And I realized that all of these, every one of these deposits occur in that same anticlinal crest environment that I talked about before. Working with one of my former colleagues from Johns Hopkins University, Bruce Marsh, who worked on the spacing, the regular spacing of volcanoes and the Aleutians, we realized that magmas for each one of these systems may have, in fact, represented what are called Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities or gravitational separations that a liquid body goes producing fingers. And the spacing of these deposits down here was about 7 kilometers, and Bruce was able to show that that was a likely spacing for the viscosity and the conditions under which we think magma ascent occurred. So we had a good new model of how ore deposits might have formed here, and I discovered in passing there was a gap, and we focused our mapping in that over a 4-year period and made a new discovery. I mentioned that we use state-of-the-art methods. This is a pen tablet with a GPS on it, so we have full topographic maps, ortho images, our samplings all put in there. So we map out in the woods with good mapping technology. Even in the woods, though, we were able to, in areas with very poor exposure, use tree root heave mounds to figure out what the rocks were. And if you do enough of that, you make beautiful maps in areas that were impossible to make a decent geological map in before. And in the process of doing that, we discovered a mineralized breccia right at the surface, a gossan that is actually highly mineralized. And again, it occurred exactly where our model predicted. It was just a matter of doing enough boot and leather work to actually go where prospectors hadn't been before to find a new deposit. We don't yet know how big it is, but it's certainly an interesting zone of mineralization. Incidentally, the really big ore bodies like Butte and Bingham that used to stick out of the ground that were much easier to find are very rare now. It's getting much harder to find deposits around the world, which means a lot more science is going in now to actually discovery. I mentioned that we did a overlay of environmental sensitivity. This is Western Montana in terms of proposed wilderness areas in green, proposed recreation in purple, and timber suitable for harvesting in yellow. That's where the Clementine zone is, and this is that belt of other older deposits going down towards Bannock there. So I purposely went in an opposite direction from proposed wilderness areas. And what we have is something that we think is really only likely mineable to 21st century deep underground mining. We were looking for a deep underground target, not something that would be a great big open pit with a huge footprint. By doing assays with wonderful multi-element ICP-MS packages now, we discovered that in addition to copper, we had also molybdenum, tungsten, rhenium, A host of light transition metals over here, as well as silver and some mercury. But we discovered that we had a host of so-called metalloid elements, kinds of elements that include arsenic, antimony, tellurium, and gallium that are the substance of semiconductors. And having had an appointment in material science as well as geology, I've been very interested in what the earth, the raw materials for those things are going to be in the future. They're important to us. I mentioned earlier also that this light-emitting diode is part of our logo. Typical white LED is a boron, is a gallium nitride material, and the first commercial manufacturing of a white LED was a real milestone in technology. In fact, the three Japanese scientists who did that won the Nobel Prize in Physics 3 years ago. If we look now at some of the applications of these semiconductors, they're widespread now in terms of gallium nitride and wireless power, LIDAR, self-driving cars, non-invasive X-ray pills, robotic power without wires, and imagery of all types. And there's a whole host of these compounds, the gallium phosphide, gallium arsenide, antimonide, indium antimonide. And the reason why these are really important is that they are part of what are called high electron mobility transistors, really fast materials for making CPUs and computers. And if any of you ever heard of a Cray computer a decade or so ago, it was a gallium arsenide, not a silicon chip that actually allowed Seymour Cray to actually revolutionize computing. In terms of use of light, which is nearly infinite source of energy on the planet, not only do we need copper for wires, but what we're finding is that if you make a layer cake stratigraphy to photovoltaics, you can harvest light at very different frequencies and wavelengths, so that you can have a germanium material that harvests light around 1400 nanometers, but below that you can put a gallium arsenide or a gallium indium phosphide, so you're not wasting sunlight, you're getting energy across a very broad sunlight spectrum. So let me get on to the permitting process here. This, again, in this relational context, I needed to work with both the DEQ and the Forest Service to get a plan of operation, and I felt blessed from the day that started, you know, with the Forest Service, because a host of scientists came out from the Forest Service that actually worked in the field with me to see how they could help us actually implement a plan that was environmentally sound, and I learned a lot from all of these people. So one thing I want to include in this talk is acknowledgments here, obviously for Susie Anderson for organizing this. But within the U.S. Forest Service itself, there were a number of different specialists, including geology and environmental fields, botany, hydrogeology, archaeology, and so on. These people were not regulators. They were compliance scientists who were actually helping us do our job better. And that's a key part of the front end of the mine life cycle, is that when we work with people from the federal government, they are really good at what they do. Also within the DEQ, Bob Cronholm and Amanda, who's going to give a talk here very soon, were very helpful to us. And we couldn't have done what we did without the input of scientists spanning this broad spectrum of human endeavor in mining. The third part of this relational enterprise I mentioned is community outreach. And I've done that differently than I think a lot of big corporations do. Being a new junior, we looked at it in a very different way. Well, for one thing, we live in Wise River a good part of every year. And so this environment is local. These people are our friends. We really value the Big Hole River and the whole ecosystems there. And I've learned from all these people. And so I invented a type of community engagement, which are 4 or 5 day-long activities on Saturdays, starting with lectures, but then ending up in the field. K-12 teachers that are credentialed can get 28 professional development units for doing this. And that's our URL for this for this endeavor we call Earth Book Montana. The basic idea is to teach people enough geology that they can read a simplified geological map and actually understand it. And you may have realized people don't know a lot about many different sciences. Well, geology is a perfect example, because they have a hard time imagining the large crustal plates that are responsible for making things like the Rocky Mountains. You can't understand geology unless you look much larger than most people's perspective takes them. And the time scale is an anathema to them. But you can slowly bring a group of interested people along to a stunning level of understanding. And I've this is probably the hardest teaching I've ever done over a 36-year career in academia, but one of the most rewarding experiences. If you're interested, you're welcome to join us. The schedule is right there on the link, and we talk about a whole host of topics that would broaden people's horizons and put ore deposits in a context of environment and many other dimensions. I'm joined by a colleague, Alta Miller from Dewey, Montana, who puts on wonderful historical picture essays. Then we have afternoon field trips. And the bottom line is we go far beyond what is typical of transparency in the corporate world, which is good. But what I realized is that we want to communicate exploration activities over a multi-year program in field trips, starting with a questionnaire where they told us what they wanted to learn about the Earth. Rather than us tell them what we're going to show them, we asked them. I learned a lot from that. And to provide enough geology for attendees to understand exploration in a scientific, historical, economic, environmental, and social context, so that they have more than kind of a reflexive knee-jerk reaction to anything. They actually can understand when somebody shows them something at a much greater depth than they would otherwise. We're focused on geological reality, what broad knowledge of science is essential to fulfilling our charter as a country of informed citizens. For example, this is a new map published by the Montana Bureau of Mines and Geology. It's simplified, but we start with that. These red things are blobs of magma, and we take them to places like the Spires. We go along the Big Hole River to see why there's so many rock falls that come down there. We talk about jointing and geological hazards. And it basically brings people into a geological realm that's been partially invisible for them. And we use their experience to expand on that. We take them to some of these great old districts like Argenta and Bannock. We see some of their stops, such as Crystal Park, in a context so they actually understand what that is, and in a host of other places. Topics I've listed here as examples include the age of the Earth and give examples of rocks of those different ages so that they can look at a Permian age rock or a Triassic rock. We talk about geological hazards like rock falls, the failure of some of the Earthfield dams up on the Wise River at Pattengale, the places of interest they pick like Humbug Spires. They ask me about global warming. What is the evidence for it? What could be the impact? Do a lot on the Butte ore deposit, and I show them how exploration actually works, and they get out of that something much broader, which is how does science work? You know, why is it driven not by answers but by questions? And that's something the public really doesn't get. It's those of us that think up questions that take us in directions where answers have meaning. We talk about Yellowstone as a hot spot, and then Glacier Park with the chief mountain thrust there, where they can actually see the same thrust system that made the ore deposit, you know, where Butte is or Bingham or Clementine. These are some of the rock falls along the Big Hole River, and then Alta Miller's historical photos really enliven this discussion, and it brings people's personal family history into a very interesting context by showing them something that they heard from their grandparents, only now they see it in the context that's much broader. Some of the things we talk about are global temperature variation, And we're looking back here at about 550 million years up to the present, looking at our evidence for how temperature changed, when there were glacial episodes, sea level variation. That red curve is Peter Vail's curve from Exxon. We know a whole lot about sea level change and temperature and for the last 550 million years. And they want the real deal. They don't want somebody, you know, some politician telling them a story. They want to see what is the evidence that geologists and glaciologists have put together. I also show them actual isotope records. This is from the end of the Cretaceous, about 63 million years up to the present. The Earth has been cooling largely, contrary to what people think. Our polar ice cap started in here somewhere, and we've been getting more and more ice until very recently we're seeing that ice melt. And that's related to the production of a number of greenhouse gases that we as humans collectively create. And so I talk about how we could have a man-made marine transgression that could inundate coastal cities. The hardest thing for me to get them to understand is the geological column from the Precambrian up to the present, but I do it in a way where the local stratigraphic layers and the rock formations are put in context and related to major extinction events. And there's actually five of them that I talk about here. And I also show how these rocks relate to we can understand these rocks in terms of very simple limestone, sandstone, shale, granites. They don't have to learn 50 rocks, they can learn four. And we show them that at a number of different times, if, for example, the Permian-Triassic boundary here at about 250, life almost died on the planet. 95% of marine species died out then. I can show them Permian and Triassic rocks right along the Big Hole River, right behind one of the bars. In fact, we've changed the conversation in that bar a little bit by getting people to think about geological time and mass extinction. Then finally, if I see them go to Yellowstone, go to a glacier and look at the Chief Mountain Thrust up here, they realize that's Precambrian age rocks stuck on top of Cretaceous rocks as a great big outlier, a clipper. All of a sudden, I realize they've gotten something out of coming to Saturday school with us. So let me end up with our pilot diamond drilling. This was a major challenge because we're way about 8,000 feet in the national forest. We want to do this right. We had to get access, get a serious diamond drill in there. Water supply was a challenge, and I solved that problem by realizing that right on the way from I-15 into our prospect is a great big filtration plant, from Big Hole River before it goes into Butte. We could hook up a hydrant meter on the back of a tanker truck on several days, several times a day, go up and fill that up. So that was an important thing for us. But we ran almost a mile of half-inch polyline to deliver water from the tank out to the drill site, just with gravity head. No pumps were required. We didn't have extra fire hazard, by having diesel pumps going. We just used gravity. And then finally, even though our drilling was a lot shorter than we'd hoped for in the first season, we in fact showed that we had a veinlet stockwork of low-grade copper, silver, arsenic, antimony, relic sulfides there, and that's exactly what we were looking for. The depth, we found the same kind of mineralization we were seeing on the surface. And that confirmed two key aspects. We had intense hydrofracturing that guided mineralization, and it increased the level of certainty of the deposit being silver, copper, with a host of metalloids, and not a gold deposit that would have antimony and mercury associated with it. So let me just end by saying that all these different phases in this relational effort we've made are equally important. And key one to us was to do the most environmentally sound work we could all along the way, and that meant in interacting with a host of different kinds of scientists that were key to our success so far. So thank you.
George, George, where did the students come from that participated in your Saturday session?
We didn't have many students. They were mainly participants. Okay, they were mainly from Wise River, but a number came from Butte. In past years, I had other renditions of this. This started almost 10 or 15 years ago when they have a thing called the Weed Whackers Ball, where they raise money to get chemicals to spray knapweed and so on. So they asked me then to do a geology day, and then I was sold in this silent auction. And that started off with families getting involved, and then it became part of something the Wise River Foundation supports. And so they come, I've had people, you know, come as far as way as Spokane to some of these things. And you can read about the Montana Standard pretty soon. We'll put an article in there.
Other questions?
Do you have a proposal? Do you have a proposal for future drilling this year?
Yes. Yeah, we're permitted to drill this year too.
Yep. Any questions, everybody?
Were you surprised by the level of interest in folks who wanted to come out and learn about the work you're doing?
No, because it started, you know, almost a decade ago with them, you know, wanting to have family day geology with us, and then we did it for the two-room schoolroom for years.
So you did this before your work here at Clementine?
Yeah. This Clementine is only the last 4 years since I retired. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, George. Our next presentation is by Amanda Miller.
Environmental science.